This is Audible.
Penguin Audio presents The Door to December, written by Dean Koontz. Read by George Guidel. Part 1. The Grey Room. Wednesday, 2:50 a.m. to 8 a.m. Chapter 1. As soon as she finished dressing, Laura went to the front door and was just in time to see the Los Angeles Police Department squad car pull to the curb in front of the house. She stepped outside, slammed the door behind her, and hurried down the walk. Hard spikes of cold rain nailed the night to the city. She hadn't bothered with an umbrella. She couldn't remember which closet she'd stuck it in, and she didn't want to waste time searching for it. Thunder rolled across the dark sky, but she hardly noticed those ominous peals. To her, the pounding of her own heart was the loudest noise in the night. The driver's door of the black and white opened, and a uniformed officer got out. He saw her coming, got back in, reached across the seat, and opened the front door on the passenger side. She sat next to him, pulled the door shut. With one cold and tremulous hand, she pushed a damp strand of hair away from her face and tucked it behind her ear. The patrol car smelled strongly of pine-scented disinfectant and, vaguely, of vomit. The young patrolman said, "Mrs. McCaffrey?" "Yes. I'm Carl Quaid. I'll take you to Lieutenant Haldane." "And to my husband," she said anxiously. "I don't know about that. I was told they found Dylan, my husband." "Most likely Lieutenant Haldane will tell you about that." She gagged, choked, shook her head in disgust. Quaid said, "Sorry about the stink in here. Arrested a guy for drunken driving earlier tonight, and he had the manners of a pig." The odor was not what made her stomach twist and roll. She felt sick because, on the phone, a few minutes ago, they had told her that her husband had been found, but they hadn't mentioned Melanie. And if Melanie was not with Dylan, where was she? Still missing? Dead? No. Unthinkable. Laura put a hand to her mouth, gritted her teeth, held her breath, waited for the nausea to subside. She said, Where are we going?"
"A house in Studio City, not far."
"Is that where they found Dylan?"
"If they told you they found him, I guess that's the place."
"How'd they locate him? I didn't even know you people were looking for him. The police told me there was no cause for their involvement. It wasn't their jurisdiction. I thought there was no chance I'd ever see him or Melanie again."
"You'll have to talk with Lieutenant Haldane.
Dylan must have robbed a bank or something." She couldn't conceal her bitterness. Stealing a child from her mother isn't enough to interest the police.
"Buckle your seatbelt, please."
Laura fumbled nervously with the belt as they drove away from the curb, and Quaid hung a U-turn in the middle of the deserted, rain-swept street. She said, "What about my Melanie?"
"How's that?"
"My daughter. Is she all right?"
"Sorry, I don't know anything about that either."
"Wasn't she with my husband?"
"Don't think so."
"I haven't seen her in almost 6 years.
"Custody dispute?" he asked.
"No. He kidnapped her."
"Really?"
"Well, the law called it a custody dispute. But as far as I'm concerned, it's kidnapping, pure and simple."
Anger and resentment took possession of her when she thought of Dylan. She tried to overcome those emotions, tried not to hate him, because she suddenly had the crazy notion that God was watching her, that he was judging her, and that if she became consumed by hatred or dwelt on negative thoughts, he would decide that she wasn't worthy of being reunited with her little girl. Crazy. She couldn't help it. Fear made her crazy. And it made her so weak that for a moment she didn't even have sufficient strength to draw a breath. Dylan. Laura wondered what it would be like to come face to face with him again. What could he possibly say to her that would explain his treachery? And what could she say to him that would be adequate to express her outrage and pain? She had been trembling, but now she began to shake violently.
"You okay?" Quaid asked.
"Yes,"
she lied. Quaid said nothing. With the emergency beacons flashing, but without using the siren, they raced across the storm-lashed west side of the city. As they sped through deep puddles, water plumed on both sides, eerily phosphorescent, like frothy white curtains drawing back to let them pass.
"She'd be 9 years old now," Laura said. "My daughter, I mean. I can't give you much more of a description. I mean, the last time I saw her, she was only 3.
Sorry, I didn't see any little girl.
Auburn hair, green eyes. The cop said nothing.
Melanie must be with Dylan, Laura said desperately, torn between joy and terror. She was jubilant at the prospect of seeing Melanie again, but afraid that the girl was dead. Laura had dreamed so often about finding Melanie's corpse in one hideous condition or another. Now she suspected the recurring nightmare would prove to have been an omen.
She must be with Dylan. That's where she's been all these years, 6 long years, so why wouldn't she be with him now?
We'll be there in a few minutes, Quaid said. Lieutenant Haldane can answer all your questions.
They wouldn't wake me at 2:30 in the morning, drag me out in the middle of a storm, if they hadn't found Melanie, too. Surely they wouldn't.
Quaid concentrated on his driving, and his silence was worse than anything he could have told her. The thumping windshield wipers couldn't quite clean the glass. A persistent, greasy film distorted the world beyond, so Laura felt as though she was riding through a dream. Her palms were sweating. She blotted them on her jeans. She felt sweat trickle out of her armpits, down her sides. The rope of nausea in her stomach knotted tighter.
"Is she hurt?" Laura asked. "Is that it? Is that why you don't want to tell me anything about her?"
Quaid glanced at her.
"Really, Mrs. McCaffrey, I didn't see any little girl at the house. I'm not hiding anything from you."
Laura slumped back against the seat. She was on the verge of tears, but was determined not to cry. Tears would be an admission that she had lost all hope of finding Melanie alive. And if she lost hope, another crazy thought, then she might actually be responsible for the child's death because, crazier, maybe Melanie's continued existence was like that of Tinkerbell and Peter Pan, sustained only by constant and ardent belief. She was aware that a quiet hysteria had seized her. The idea that Melanie's continued existence depended upon her mother's belief and restraint of tears was solipsistic and irrational. Nevertheless, she clung to the idea, fighting back tears, summoning all the conviction that she could muster. The windshield wipers thumped monotonously, and the rain drummed hollowly on the roof, and the tires hissed on the wet pavement, and Studio City seemed as far away as Hong Kong. They turned off Ventura Boulevard in Studio City, a community of mismatched architecture, Spanish, Cape Cod, Tudor, colonial, and postmodern homes jammed side by side. It had been named for the old Republic studios, where many low-budget westerns had been shot before the advent of television. Most of Studio City's newest residents were screenwriters, painters, artists, artisans, musicians, and craftspeople of all kinds. Refugees from gradually but inevitably decaying neighborhoods such as Hollywood, who were now engaged in a battle of lifestyles with the older homeowners. Officer Quaid pulled to a stop in front of a modest ranch house, on a quiet cul-de-sac lined with winter-bare coral trees and Indian laurels with heavy foliage. Several vehicles were clustered in the street, including 2 mustard-green Ford sedans, 2 other black and whites, and a gray van with the city's seal on the door. But it was another van that caught and held Laura's attention, for Coroner was emblazoned across the 2 rear doors.
"Oh, God, please. No, no."
Laura closed her eyes, trying to believe that this was still part of the dream from which the telephone had ostensibly awakened her. The call from the police actually might have been part of the nightmare, in which case Quaid was part of it too, and this house. She would wake up, and none of this would be real. But when she opened her eyes, the coroner's van was still there. The windows of the house were heavily curtained, but the entire front was bathed in the harsh glow of portable floodlights. Silvery rain slanted through the bright light, and the shivering shadows of the wind-stirred shrubbery crawled across the walls. A uniformed policeman in a rain slicker was stationed at the curb. Another officer stood under the roof that overhung the area around the front door. They were prepared to discourage curious neighbors and other onlookers, although the bad weather and late hours seemed to be doing their job for them. Quaid got out of the car, but Laura couldn't move. He leaned back in and said, "This is the place." Laura nodded, but still didn't move.
She didn't want to go inside. She knew what she would find. Melanie, dead. Quaid waited a moment, then came around the car and opened her door. He held out one hand to her. The wind sprayed fat droplets of cold rain past Quaid into the car. He frowned. "Mrs. McCaffrey, are you crying?" She couldn't shift her gaze from the coroner's van. When it drove off with Melanie's small body, it would carry Laura's hope away as well, and would leave her with a future as dead as her daughter. In a voice no less tremulous than the wind-shaken leaves on the Indian laurels, she said, "You lied to me."
"Huh? Hey, no, not at all. Really?"
She wouldn't look at him, blowing air between his lips, making an odd horse-like sound that was hardly appropriate to the circumstances. He said,
"Well, yeah, this is a homicide case. We've got a couple of bodies."
A scream swelled in her, and when she held it back, the pent-up pressure was a painful burning in her chest. Quaid quickly continued,
"But your little girl isn't in there. She's not one of the bodies. Honestly, she isn't."
Laura finally met his eyes. He seemed sincere. There would be no point in lying to her now, because she would soon learn the truth anyway, when she went inside. She got out of the car. Taking her by the arm, Officer Quaid led her up the walk to the front door. The rain pounded as solemnly as drums in a funeral cortege. Chapter 2. The guard went inside to get Lieutenant Haldane. Laura and Quaid waited under the overhang, sheltered from the worst of the wind and rain. The night smelled of ozone and roses. Rose bushes twined around support stakes along the front of the house, and in California most varieties bloomed even in the winter. The flowers drooped, soggy and heavy in the rain. Haldane arrived without delay. He was tall, broad-shouldered, roughly hewn, with short sandy hair and a square, appealing Irish face. His blue eyes looked flat, like twin ovals of painted glass, and Laura wondered if they always looked that way, or whether they were flat and lifeless tonight because of what he had seen in the house. He was wearing a tweed sport coat, a white shirt, a tie with the knot loosened, gray slacks and black loafers. Except for his eyes, he looked like a comfortable, easygoing, laid-back sort of guy, and there was genuine warmth in his brief smile.
"Dr. McCaffrey, I'm Dan Haldane. My daughter, we haven't found Melanie yet. She isn't..."
"What?
Dead?"
"No, no. Good heavens, no, not your girl. I wouldn't have brought you here if that had been the case." She felt no relief because she wasn't sure that she believed him. He was tense, edgy. Something horrible had happened in this house, she was sure of it. And if they hadn't found Melanie, why had they brought her out at this hour? What was wrong? Haldane dismissed Carl Quaid, who headed back through the rain to the patrol car.
"Dylan? My husband?"
Laura asked. Haldane's stare slid away from hers.
"Yes, we think we've located him."
"He's dead?"
"Well, yeah, apparently it's him. We've got a body carrying his ID, but we haven't positively tagged him yet. We'll need a dental records check or a fingerprint match to make it positive."
The news of Dylan's death had surprisingly little effect on her. She felt no loss, because she'd spent 6 years hating him. But she wasn't happy about it either. No glee, no triumph or satisfaction. No sense that Dylan had gotten what he deserved. He had been an object of love, then hatred, now indifference. She felt absolutely nothing. And perhaps that was the saddest thing of all. The wind changed direction. Icy rain blew under the overhang. Haldane drew Laura back into the corner, as far as they could go. She wondered why he didn't take her inside. There must be something that he didn't want her to see, something too horrible for her to see. What in the name of God had happened in there?
"How did he die?"
she asked.
"Murdered."
"Who did it?"
"We don't know."
"Shot?"
"No. He was beaten to death."
"My God." She felt sick.
She leaned against the wall because her legs were suddenly weak.
Dr. McCaffrey?
Concerned, he took her by the arm, ready to provide support if she needed it.
I'm okay, she said.
But I expected Dylan and Melanie to be together. Dylan took her away from me.
I know.
6 years ago. He closed out our bank accounts, quit his job, and ran off because I wanted a divorce. And he wasn't willing to share custody of Melanie.
When we put his name in the computer, he gave us you, the whole file,
Haldane said.
I haven't had time to learn the particulars, but I read the highlights on the mobile VDT in the car, so I'm sort of familiar with the case.
He ruined his life, threw away his career and everything to be able to keep Melanie. Surely she must still be with him, Laura said exasperatedly.
She was. She was living here with him.
Living? Here? Here? Only 10 or 15 minutes from me?
That's right.
But I hired private detectives, several of them, and nobody could get a lead.
Sometimes, Haldane said, the purloined letter trick is the best trick of all.
I thought maybe they'd even left the country, gone to Mexico or somewhere. And all the time, they were right here.
The wind subsided, and the rain came straight down, even heavier than before. The lawn would soon be a lake. There are some clothes here for a little girl, Haldane said. Several books, suitable for a kid her age. There's a box of Count Chocula cereal in the cupboard, and I'm sure none of the adults was eating that.
None of them? There were more people here than just Dylan and Melanie?
We're not sure. We've got other bodies. We think one of them was living here because there were men's clothes in two sizes, some of which would fit your husband, but some that might fit one of the other men.
How many bodies?
Two others, three altogether.
Beaten to death?
He nodded.
And you don't know where Melanie is?
Not yet.
So, maybe whoever killed Dylan and the others took her away with him?
It's a possibility, he said.
Even if Melanie wasn't already dead, she was the hostage of a killer. Maybe not just a killer, but a rapist.
No.
She was only 9 years old. What would a rapist want with her? She was hardly more than a baby. Of course, these days, that didn't make any difference. There were strange animals out there, monsters who preyed on children, who had a special appetite for little girls.
She was far colder than the incessant winter rain.
We've got to find her, Laura said, and her voice was a thin croak that she didn't even recognize.
We're trying, Haldane said. She saw sympathy and compassion in his blue eyes now, but she could take no comfort from him. I'd like you to come inside with me, he said, but I have to warn you. It's not a pretty scene.
I'm a doctor, Lieutenant.
Yeah, but a psychiatrist.
And a medical doctor. All psychiatrists are medical doctors.
Oh, that's right. I didn't think.
I assume you want me to identify Dylan's body.
No. I'm not going to ask you to look at it. Wouldn't do any good. The condition... No visual identification is really possible. There's something else I want you to see, something I hope you might be able to explain to me.
What's that?
Something weird, he said. Something damned weird.
Chapter 3
Every lamp and ceiling light in the house was blazing. Laura blinked against the glare as she looked around. The living room was furnished neatly but without style. The sectional sofa, covered in a bold geometric pattern, clashed with the floral drapes. The carpet was one shade of green, the walls another. Only the bookcases, and the few hundred volumes in them, appeared to have been collected with genuine interest and to a particular taste. The rest of the room might have been a stage set, hastily assembled by a theater company with a small budget. At the cold fireplace, a cheap black tin container had tipped over, spilling wrought iron tools across the white brick hearth. Two lab technicians were dusting powder over exposed surfaces and lifting tape impressions where they found fingerprints.
"Please don't touch anything," Haldane told Laura. "If you don't need me to identify Dylan, like I said, it wouldn't do much good."
"Why?"
"Nothing to identify."
"Surely the body can't be that badly battered," he said. "No face left."
"My God!"
They stood in the foyer by the living room arch. Haldane seemed as reluctant to take her deeper into the house as he had been to bring her inside in the first place.
"Did he have any identifying marks?"
Haldane asked. "A discolored patch of skin."
"Birthmark?"
"Yes."
"Where?"
"The middle of his chest."
Haldane shook his head. "Probably won't help."
"Why not?"
He stared at her, then looked away at the floor.
"I'm a doctor," she reminded him.
His chest was caved in.
"Beaten in?"
"Yeah. Every rib broken and rebroken. Breastbone smashed like a china plate."
"Smashed?"
"Yeah. The word's carefully chosen, Dr. McCaffrey. Not just broken. Not just fractured or splintered. Smashed. Like he was made of glass."
"That's impossible."
"Saw it with my own eyes. Wish I hadn't.
But the breastbone is solid. That and the skull are the closest things the human body has to armor plating."
"The killer was one big, strong son of a bitch."
She shook her head. "Now, you might smash the breastbone in an auto accident, where there are tremendous forces, sudden impacts at 50 and 60 miles an hour, crushing forces and weights, but it couldn't happen in a beating.
We figure a lead pipe or..."
"Not even that," she said. "Smashed? Surely not." "Melanie, my little Melanie, my God, what's happened to you? Where have they taken you? Will I ever see you again?" She shuddered. "Listen, if you don't need me to identify Dylan, then I'm not sure what help I can..."
"Like I said, there's something I want you to see."
"Something weird?"
"Yeah." Yet he kept her in the foyer, and even seemed to be using his body to prevent her from seeing farther into the house. Clearly, he was torn between his need for the information that she might be able to give him and his dismay at having to drag her through the scene of such bloody murders.
"I don't understand," she said. "Weird? What?"
Haldane didn't answer the question. He said, "You and he were in the same line of work."
"Not exactly."
"He was a psychiatrist too, wasn't he?"
"No, a behavioral psychologist, with a special interest in behavior modification."
"And you're a psychiatrist, a medical doctor?"
"I specialize in the treatment of children."
"Yes, I see. Different fields."
"Very."
He frowned. "Well, if you have a look at his lab, you still might be able to tell me what your husband was doing there."
"Lab? He was working here, too?"
"He was primarily working here. I don't think that he or your daughter led much of a real life in this place."
"Working? Doing what?"
"Experiments of some sort. We can't figure it."
"Let's have a look. It's
messy," he said, studying her closely.
"I told you I'm a doctor."
"Yeah, and I'm a cop. And a cop sees more blood than a doctor does, and this was so messy it made me sick."
"Lieutenant, you brought me here, and now you're not getting rid of me until I know what my husband and my little girl were doing in this house."
He nodded. "This way."
She followed him past the living room, away from the kitchen, into a short hallway, where a slender, good-looking Latino in a dark suit was overseeing two men whose uniform jackets were stenciled with the word coroner. They were stowing a corpse in an opaque plastic body bag. One of the men from the coroner's office pulled up the zipper. Through the milky plastic, Laura saw only a lumpish, man-shaped form, no details, but a few thick smears of blood.
"Dylan?"
"Not your husband," Haldane said, as if reading her mind. "This one wasn't carrying any ID at all. We'll have to rely entirely on a fingerprint check." More blood was spattered and streaked over the walls, pooled on the floor, lots of it. So much that it didn't seem real, like a scene in a cheap horror film. A plastic runner had been put down along the center of the hall, so the investigating officers and technicians wouldn't have to step in the blood and get their shoes sticky. Haldane glanced at her, and she tried not to let him see how scared she was. Had Melanie been here when the murders had taken place? If she had been, and if she was now, with the man or men who had done this, she was marked for death, too, because she had been a witness. Even if she had seen nothing, the murderer would kill her when he was through with her. No doubt about that. He would kill her because he would enjoy killing her. From the look of this place, he was a psychopath. A sane person would not have slaughtered with such savage, blood-spraying glee. The coroner's two men went outside to get a wheeled stretcher on which the body could be removed. The slender Latino in the dark suit turned to Haldane. His voice was surprisingly deep. "We vacuumed the place, Lieutenant, finished with photographs, lifted what prints we could, all the rest of it. We're moving his victim out." "See anything special in the preliminary exam, Joey?" Haldane asked. Laura supposed Joey was a police pathologist, although he was badly shaken for someone who should have been accustomed to scenes of violent death. Joey said, "Looks like nearly every bone in the body was broken at least once. One contusion atop another. Hundreds. No way to tell how many. I'm positive an autopsy is going to show ruptured organs, damaged kidneys." He glanced uneasily at Laura, as if not certain he should go on. She maintained a bland expression of professional interest that she hoped didn't look as phony and sick as it felt. Joey continued. "Crushed skull. Teeth broken loose. One eye was jarred out of its socket." Laura saw a fireplace poker on the floor against the baseboard. "Is that the murder weapon?"
"We don't think so," Haldane said. "And Joey said it was in this guy's hand. Had to pry it out of his fingers. He was trying to defend himself."
Staring at the opaque body bag, they fell into a mutual silence. The ceaseless percussion of the rain on the roof was simultaneously a mundane and strange sound, like the rumble of enormous doors sliding open in a dream to reveal a mysterious and unearthly vista. The other men returned with the wheeled stretcher. One of the wheels wobbled erratically, like a malfunctioning supermarket cart, a cold, clattering noise. Three doors led off the short hall, one on each side and one at the end. All three were ajar. Haldane led Laura around the corpse and into the room at the end of the passageway. In spite of her warm sweater and lined raincoat, she was cold, freezing. Her hands were so white they looked dead. She knew the heat was on because she felt the warm air blowing out of the vents when she passed them, so she knew the chill came from within her. The room had once been an office study, but now it was a monument to destruction and chaos. Steel file drawers were ripped from their cabinets, scraped and dented, handles twisted off. The contents were scattered across the floor. A heavy chrome and walnut desk was on its side. Two of its metal legs were bent, and the wood was cracked and splintered as if it had taken a few blows from an axe. A typewriter had been thrown against one wall with such force that several keys had snapped off and were embedded in the drywall board. Papers were everywhere, typewritten sheets, graphs, pages covered with figures and notations in a small, precise handwriting, many of them shredded or crumpled or wadded into tight balls. And there was blood everywhere. On the floor, the furniture, the rubble, the walls, even on the ceiling. The place had a raw, coppery smell.
"Jesus," she said.
"What I want you to see is in the next room," he said, leading her toward a door at the rear of the demolished study. She noticed two opaque plastic body bags on the floor. Looking back at her, Haldane again said, "Next room." Laura didn't want to stop, but she stopped. She didn't want to look down at the two shrouded bodies, but she looked. She said,
"Is one of these Dylan?"
Haldane had moved ahead of her. Now he returned to her side.
"This one had Dylan McCaffrey's ID," he said, pointing. "But you don't want to see him."
"No," she agreed, "I don't."
She glanced at the other bag. "Who was this one?"
According to the driver's license and other cards in his wallet, his name was Wilhelm Hoffritz.
She was astonished. Her surprise must have been evident, for Haldane said, "Do you know him?"
"He was at the university. One of my husband's colleagues."
"UCLA?"
"Yes. Dylan and Hoffritz conducted a number of joint studies. They shared some of the same obsessions.
Do I detect disapproval?
She said nothing.
You didn't like Hoffritz? Haldane pressed.
I despised him.
Why?
He was a smug, self-important, condescending, pompous, arrogant little man.
What else?
Isn't that enough?
You're not the kind of woman who would use the word despise lightly, Haldane said. When she met his stare, she saw a sharp and probing intelligence that she hadn't noticed before. She closed her eyes. Haldane's direct gaze was discomforting. But she didn't want to look anywhere else because anywhere else was sure to be smeared with blood.
She said, Hoffritz believed in centralized social planning. He was interested in the use of psychology, drugs, and various forms of subliminal conditioning to reform and direct the masses.
Haldane was silent. Then, mind control?
That's right.
Her eyes were still closed, her head bowed.
He was an elitist.
No, that's too kind. He was a totalitarian.
He would have made an equally good Nazi or communist, either one. He had no politics except the politics of raw power. He wanted to control.
They do that kind of research at UCLA?
She opened her eyes and saw that he wasn't kidding. Of course. It's a great university, a free university. There aren't any overt restrictions on the directions a scientist's research can take if he can round up the funding for it.
But the consequence of that kind of research... Smiling sourly, she said,
empirical results, breakthroughs, the advancement of knowledge, that's what a researcher is concerned about, Lieutenant, not consequences.
You said your husband shared Hoffritz's obsession. You mean he was deep into research with mind control applications?
Yes. But he wasn't a fascist like Willy Hoffritz. He was more interested in modifying the behavior of criminal personalities as a means of reducing the crime rate. At least I think that's what he was interested in. That's what he talked most about. But the more involved Dylan got with any project, the more obsessed with it, the less he talked about it. As if talking used up energy that could be better spent in thought and work.
He received government grants?
Dylan, yes. Both him and Hoffritz.
Pentagon?
Maybe. But he wasn't primarily defense-oriented.
Why?
What does that have to do with this?
He didn't answer. You told me your husband quit his position at the university when he ran off with your daughter.
Yes.
But now we find he was still working with Hoffritz.
Hoffritz is no longer at UCLA. Hasn't been for 3 or 4 years, maybe longer.
What happened?
I don't know, she said. I just heard through the grapevine that he'd gone on to other things. And I had the feeling that he'd been asked to leave.
Why?
The rumor was some violation of professional ethics.
What?
I don't know. Ask someone at UCLA.
You're not associated with the university?
No, I'm not in research. I work at St. Mark's Children's Hospital, and I have a small private practice besides. Maybe if you talked to someone at UCLA, you'd be able to find out just what it was Hoffritz did to make himself unwelcome.
She no longer felt ill, no longer minded the blood. In fact, she hardly noticed it.
There was too much horror to absorb. It numbed the mind. A single corpse and a single drop of blood would have had a more lasting effect on her than this reeking slaughterhouse. She realized why cops could so quickly become inured to scenes of bloody violence. You either adapted or went mad. And the second option was really no option at all.
Haldane said, I think your husband and Hoffritz were working together again, here, in this house.
Doing what?
I'm not sure. That's why I wanted you to come here. That's why I want you to see the lab in the next room. Maybe you can tell me what the hell was going on.
Let's have a look.
He hesitated. There's just one thing.
What?
Well, I think your daughter was an integral part of their experiments.
Laura stared at him.
He said, I think they were using her.
How?
she whispered. "That's something you'll have to tell me," the detective said. "I'm no scientist. All I know is what I read in the newspapers. But before we go in there, you should know. It looks to me as if some parts of these experiments were painful."
"Melanie, what did they want from you? What have they done to you? Where have they taken you?"
She drew a deep breath. She blotted her sweat-damp hands on her coat. She followed Haldane into the lab.
Chapter 4
Dan Haldane was surprised at how well the woman was coping with the situation. Okay, she was a doctor, but most physicians weren't accustomed to wading through blood. At the scene of multiple violent homicides, doctors could clutch up and lose control as easily as any ordinary citizen. It wasn't just Laura McCaffrey's medical training that was carrying her through this. She also had an unusual inner strength, a toughness and resilience that Dan admired, that he found intriguing and appealing. Her daughter was missing and might be hurt, might even be dead. But until she got the answers to important questions about Melanie, she wasn't, by God, going to break down or be weak in any way. He liked her. She was lovely, too, even though she wasn't wearing any makeup and though her auburn hair was damp and frizzy from the rain. She was 36, but she looked younger. Her green eyes were clear, direct, penetrating, and beautiful, and haunted. The woman would be even more disturbed by what she would see in the makeshift lab, and Dan disliked having to take her in there. But that was the main reason he had called her out in the middle of the night. Although she hadn't seen her husband in 6 years, no one knew the man better than she knew him. Since she was a psychiatrist as well, perhaps she would recognize the nature of the experiments and research that Dylan McCaffrey had been conducting. And Dan had a hunch that he wasn't going to solve these homicides or locate Melanie until he could figure out what Dylan McCaffrey had been doing. Laura followed him through the doorway. In the gray room, he watched her face. She registered surprise, puzzlement, and uneasiness. The two-car garage had been closed off and remodeled into a single, large, windowless, relentlessly drab room. Gray ceiling, gray walls, gray carpet. Fluorescent ceiling lights glowed softly behind grayish plastic panels. Even the handles on the sliding gray closet doors were painted gray. Though the heating vents must have been bare gray metal in the first place, they also had been painted, apparently because, unpainted, they'd been shiny. No spot of color or bright work had been allowed. The effect was not merely cold and institutional, but funereal. The most impressive piece of equipment in the room was a metal tank that resembled an old-fashioned iron lung, although it was considerably larger than that. It was painted the same drab gray as the room. Pipes led from it into the floor, and an electrical cable went straight up to a junction box on the ceiling. 3 movable wooden steps provided access to the tank's elevated entrance hatch, which stood open. Laura went up the steps and peered inside. Dan knew what she would find. A featureless black interior that was barely illuminated by the meager light that found its way through the hatch. The sound of water stirred by the vibrations transmitted through the steps and into the tank frame. A dampish odor with a hint of salt to it. "Know what it is?" he asked.
She descended the 3 steps. "Sure. A sensory deprivation chamber."
"What was he doing with it?"
"You mean, what are its scientific applications?" Dan nodded. "Well, you fill it with a few feet of water. Actually, you use a solution of 10% magnesium sulfate in water for maximum buoyancy. Heat it to 93 degrees Fahrenheit, the temperature at which a floating body is least affected by gravity. Or, depending on the nature of the experiment, maybe you heat it to 98 degrees to reduce the differential between body temperature and water temperature. Then the subject,
which is a person, not an animal?"
She looked surprised by the question.
Dan Haldane felt woefully undereducated, but Laura didn't disparage him or let any impatience creep into her tone, and he felt at ease again almost immediately. She said, "Yes, a person, not an animal. Anyway, when the water's ready, the subject undresses, enters the chamber, closes the door after himself, and floats in total darkness, in total silence."
Why?
To deprive himself of all sensory stimulation. No sight, no sound, little or no taste, minimal olfactory stimulation, no sense of weight or place or time.
But why would anyone want to do that?
Well, initially, when the first tanks were used, they did it because they wanted to find out what would happen when someone was deprived of nearly all external stimuli.
Yeah? And what happened?
Not what they expected. No claustrophobia, no paranoia. A brief moment of fear, yes, but then a not unpleasant temporal and spatial disorientation. The sense of confinement disappeared in a minute or so. Some subjects reported being certain they were not in a small chamber but a huge one, with endless space around them. With no external stimuli to occupy it, the mind turns inward to explore a whole new world of internal stimuli.
Hallucinations.
For a moment her anxiety faded. Her professional interest in the functioning of the human mind became evident, and Dan could see that if she had chosen a career in the classroom, she would have proven a natural-born teacher. She clearly took pleasure in explaining, illuminating. She said, "Yes, hallucinations, sometimes, but not frightening or threatening hallucinations, nothing like what you'd expect from a drug experience. Intense and extraordinarily vivid sexual fantasies in many cases, and virtually every subject reports a sharpening and clearing of thought processes. Some subjects have solved complex problems in algebra and calculus without even the benefit of paper and pencil, problems that would ordinarily be beyond their abilities. There's even a cult system of psychotherapy that uses deprivation chambers to encourage the patient to concentrate on guided self-exploration."
He said, "From your tone, I think maybe you don't approve of that."
"Well, I don't exactly disapprove," she said. "But if you've got a psychologically disturbed individual who already feels adrift, only half in control of himself, the disorientation of a deprivation chamber is almost certain to have negative effects. Some patients need every grip on the physical world, every external stimulus they can get." She shrugged. "But then again, maybe I'm too cautious, old-fashioned. After all, they've been selling these things for use in private homes. Must have sold a few thousand over the past few years. And surely a few of those were used by unstable people, yet I haven't heard of anyone going all the way around the bend because of it."
"Must be expensive."
"A tank? Sure is. Most units in private homes are new toys for the rich, I guess."
"Why would anyone buy one for his home?"
"Aside from the hallucinatory period and the eventual clarity of the mental processes, everyone reports being tremendously relaxed and revitalized by a session in a tank. After you spend an hour floating, your brain waves match those of a Zen monk in deep meditation. Call it a lazy man's way to meditate. No studying required. No religious principles to be learned or obeyed. An easy way of packing a week's relaxation into a couple of hours."
"But your husband wasn't using this just to relax."
"I doubt it," she agreed.
"Then what was he after, specifically?"
"I really have no way of knowing." Anguish returned to her face, her eyes. Dan said,
"I think this wasn't just his lab. I think it was your daughter's room, too. I think she was a virtual prisoner in here. And I think she slept in this tank every night, and maybe spent days at a time in it."
"Days? No, that's not possible."
"Why isn't it?"
"The potential for psychological damage, the risks."
"Maybe your husband didn't care about the risks."
"But she was his daughter. He loved Melanie. I'll give him that much. He genuinely loved her."
"We've found a journal in which your husband seems to account for every minute of your daughter's time during the past 5.5 years.
Her eyes narrowed. "I want to see it."
"In a minute. I haven't studied it closely yet, but I don't think your daughter was ever out of this house in 5.5 years. Not to school, not to a doctor, not to a movie or the zoo or anywhere. And even if you say it's not possible, I think, from what I've seen, that she sometimes spent as much as 3 or 4 days in the tank without coming out. But food, I don't think she was fed in that time. Water, maybe she drank a little of what she was floating in. She'd have to relieve herself. From what I've seen, there were times when she might have been taken out for only 10 or 15 minutes. Long enough to use the bathroom. But in other cases, I think he catheterized her, so she could urinate into a sealed specimen jar without being taken out of the tank and without contaminating the water she was floating in. The woman looked stricken. Wanting to get this over with for her sake, and also because he was sick of this place, Dan led her away from the tank to another piece of equipment. A biofeedback machine, she told him. It includes an EEG, an electroencephalograph, to monitor brain waves. It supposedly helps you learn to control the patterns of your brain waves and, therefore, your state of mind. I know about biofeedback. He pointed past that machine. And this? It was a chair from which dangled leather straps and wires that ended in electrodes. Laura McCaffrey examined it, and Dan could sense her growing disgust and terror. At last, she said, "An aversion therapy device." "Looks like an electric chair to me." "It is, not one that kills. The current comes from those batteries, not from a wall socket. And this," she touched a lever on the side of the chair, "regulates the voltage. You can deliver anything from a tingle to a painful shock." "This is a standard psychological research device?" "Good heavens, no." "You ever see one of these in a lab before?"
"Once." "Well, twice."
"Where?" "A rather unscrupulous animal psychologist I once knew. He used electric shock aversion training with monkeys." "Tortured them?" "I'm sure he didn't see it that way." "All animal psychologists don't do that?"
"I said he was unscrupulous." "Listen, I hope you're not one of those new Luddites who think all scientists are fools or monsters."
"Not me. When I was a kid, I never missed Mr. Wizard on TV." She managed a faint smile.
"Didn't mean to snap at you."
"It's understandable. Now, you said you've seen one of these devices twice before. What about the second time?" The meager glow of her weak smile was suddenly extinguished.
"I saw the second one in a photograph."
"Oh?"
"In a book about scientific experimentation in Nazi Germany."
"I see.
They used it on people."
He hesitated, but it had to be said. "So did your husband." Laura McCaffrey regarded him not with disbelief as much as with an ardent desire to disbelieve. Her face was the color of cold ashes, burnt out. Dan said, "I think he put your daughter in this chair."
"No."
"And I think he and Hoffritz and God knows who else..."
"No."
"Tortured her," Dan finished.
"No."
"It's in the journal I told you about. But I think they were using what you called aversion therapy to teach her to control her brainwave patterns." The thought of Melanie strapped in that chair was so disturbing that Laura McCaffrey was profoundly transformed by it. She no longer looked simply burnt out, no longer just ashen. She was now paler than pale, cadaverously pallid. Her eyes appeared to sink deeper into her skull and lose much of their luster. Her face sagged like softening wax.
She said, But that doesn't make sense. Aversion therapy is the least likely way to learn biofeedback techniques."
Dan had the urge to put his arms around her, hold her close, smooth her hair, comfort her, kiss her. He had found her appealing from the moment he had seen her, but until now he'd felt no romantic stirrings for her. And that was par for the course, wasn't it? He always fell for the helpless kittens, the broken dolls, the ones who were lost or weak or in trouble. and he always wound up wishing that he had never gotten involved. Laura McCaffrey hadn't initially held any attraction for him because she had been self-confident, self-possessed, totally in control. As soon as she'd begun to flounder, as soon as she could no longer conceal her fear and confusion, he was drawn to her. Nick Hammond, another homicide detective and smart-ass, had accused Dan of having a mother-hen instinct. And there was truth in that. "What is it with me?" he wondered. "Why do I insist on being a knight-errant? Always searching for a damsel in distress? I hardly even know this woman. And I want her to rely entirely on me, put her hopes and fears on my shoulders." "Oh, yes, ma'am, you just rely on Big Dan Haldane, nobody else. Big Dan will catch these evil villains and put your broken world back together for you. Big Dan can do it, ma'am, even though he's still an adolescent idiot at heart." No, not this time. He had a job to do, and he would do it. But he would be entirely professional about it. Personal feelings would not intrude. Anyway, this woman wouldn't welcome a relationship with him. She was better educated than he was, a lot more stylish. She was a brandy type, while he was strictly beer. Besides, for God's sake, this wasn't a time for romance. She was too vulnerable. She was worried sick about her daughter. Her husband had been killed, and it must have its effect on her, even if she had stopped loving the guy a long time ago. What kind of man could think of her as a romantic prospect at a time like this? He was ashamed of himself. But still, he sighed. "Well, once you've studied your husband's journal, maybe you'll be able to prove he never put the girl in that chair, but I don't think so." She just stood there, looking lost. He went to the closet and opened the doors, revealing several pairs of jeans, T-shirts, sweaters, and shoes that would fit a 9-year-old girl. All were gray. "Why?" Dan asked. What did he hope to prove? What effect was he after with the girl? The woman shook her head, too distraught to speak. "And something else, I wonder," Dan said. "All of this, 6 years of it, took more money than he had when he cleaned out your joint bank accounts and left you. A lot more. Yet he wasn't working anywhere. He never went out. Maybe Wilhelm Hofritz gave him money, but there must have been others who contributed as well. Who? Who was financing this work?" "I've no idea." "And why?" he wondered. "And where have they taken Melanie?" she asked. "And what are they doing to her now?" Chapter 5. The kitchen wasn't exactly filthy, but it wasn't clean either. Stacks of dirty dishes filled the sink. Crumbs littered the table that stood by the room's only window. Laura sat at the table and brushed some of the crumbs aside. She was eager to look at the log of Dylan's experiments with Melanie. Haldane wasn't ready to give it to her. He held it, a ledger-sized book bound in imitation brown leather, and paced around the kitchen as he talked. Rain struck the window and streamed down the glass. When an occasional flicker of lightning brightened the night and passed through the window, it briefly projected the random rippling patterns of water from the glass onto the walls, which made the room seem as amorphous and semi-transparent as a mirage. "I want to know a lot more about your husband," Haldane said, pacing.
"Like what?"
"Like why you decided to divorce him."
"Is that relevant?"
"Could be."
"How?"
"For one thing, if there was another woman involved, then maybe she can tell us more about what he was doing here. Maybe she can even tell us who killed him."
"There was no other woman."
"Then why did you decide to divorce him?"
"It was just that I no longer loved him."
"But you had loved him once."
"Yes. But he wasn't the man I married."
"How had he changed?"
She sighed. "He didn't. He was never the man I married. I only thought he was. Later, as time went by, I realized how thoroughly I'd misunderstood him, right from the start."
Haldane stopped pacing, leaned against a counter, crossing his arms on his chest, still holding the logbook. "Just how had you misunderstood him?"
"Well,
First, you have to understand something about me. In high school and college, I was never a particularly popular girl. Never had many dates.
I find that difficult to believe.
She blushed. She wished she could control it, but couldn't. It's true. I was crushingly shy. Avoided boys, avoided everyone. Never had any close girlfriends, either.
Didn't anyone tell you about the right mouthwash and danger of shampoo?
She smiled at his attempt to put her at ease, but she was never comfortable talking about herself. I didn't want anyone to get to know me, because I figured they'd dislike me, and I couldn't stand rejection.
Why should they dislike you?
Oh, because I wouldn't be witty enough or bright enough or pretty enough to suit them.
Well, I can't say whether or not you're witty, but then David Letterman would have trouble coming up with one-liners in this place. But you're clearly intelligent. After all, you earned a doctorate. And I don't see how you could look in a mirror and think you were anything less than beautiful.
She glanced up from the crumb-carpeted table. The lieutenant's gaze was direct, engaging, warm, though neither bold nor suggestive. His attitude was merely that of a policeman making an observation, stating a fact. Yet under that surface professionalism, deep down, she sensed that he was attracted to her. His interest made her uneasy. Self-conscious, studying the vague silvery tracks of rain on the black window, she said, "I had a terrible inferiority complex back then."
"Why?"
"My parents."
"Isn't it always?"
"No, not always. But in my case, mainly my mother."
"What were your folks like?"
"They have nothing to do with this case," she said. "They're both gone now, anyway."
"Passed away?"
"Yes."
"I'm sorry."
"No need to be. I'm not."
"I see." That was a harsh thing for her to have said. She was surprised to realize that she didn't want him to think badly of her. On the other hand, she was not prepared to tell him about her parents and the loveless childhood she had endured.
"But about Dylan," she began, and then wasn't sure where she had left off.
Haldane said, "You were telling me why you misjudged him right from the start."
"See, I was so good at fending people off, so good at alienating everyone and keeping myself snug in my shell, that no one ever got close to me, especially not boys or men. I knew how to turn them off fast. Until Dylan. He wouldn't give up. He kept asking me for dates. No matter how often I rejected him, he came back. My shyness didn't deter him. Rudeness, indifference, cold rejection, nothing would stop him. He pursued me. No one had ever pursued me before. Not like Dylan. He was relentless, obsessed, but not frightening in any way, not that kind of obsession. It was corny the way he tried to impress me, the things he did. I knew it was corny at the time, but it was effective just the same. He sent flowers, more flowers, candy, more flowers, even a huge teddy bear."
"A teddy bear for a young woman working on her doctorate?" Haldane said.
"I told you it was corny. He wrote poetry and signed it A Secret Admirer. Trite, maybe, but for a woman who was 26, hardly been kissed, and expected to be an old maid, it was heady stuff. He was the first person who ever made me feel special."
"He broke down your defenses."
"Hell, I was swept away."
As she spoke of it, that special time and feeling came back to her with unnerving vividness and power. With the memories came a sadness at what might have been, a sense of lost innocence that was almost overwhelming.
Later, after we were married, I learned that Dylan's passion and fervor weren't reserved solely for me. Oh, not that there were other women, there weren't. But he pursued every interest as ardently as he'd pursued me. His research into behavior modification, his fascination with the occult, his love of fast cars. He put as much passion and energy into all those pursuits as he had put into our courtship. She remembered how she had worried about Dylan, and about the effect that his demanding personality might have on Melanie. In part, she had asked for a divorce because she had been concerned that Dylan would infect Melanie with his obsessive-compulsive behavior. For instance, he built an elaborate Japanese garden behind our house, and it consumed his every spare moment for months